Looking to connect with the brightest minds in tech transfer and innovation? Then don't miss your chance to advertise right here on Autumn on the Air. With a highly engaged audience of academic, government, and industry professionals, your message will be heard by the very people shaping the future of research commercialization. Whether you're launching a new product, building brand awareness, or recruiting top talent, the Autumn Podcast is where your message belongs. Contact info@autumn.net today to learn more.
You're listening to Autumn on the Air, the weekly podcast that brings you conversations about the impact of research commercialization and the people who make it happen. Join us for interviews with patent and licensing professionals, innovators, entrepreneurs, and tech transfer leaders on the issues and trends that matter most. Keep listening for an inside track on the people, IP policies, and politics changing our world.
Welcome to Autumn on the Air. Today, we're honored to have Dr. Jorge Goldstein, a leading figure in biotechnology law and a pioneer in intellectual property relating to life sciences. Over more than four decades, Jorge has played a pivotal role at Stern Kessler, Goldstein, and Fox, working on landmark cases shaping the boundaries of patent law for biotechnology. He is also the author of the fascinating book, Patenting Life, Tales from the Front Lines of Intellectual Property and the New Biology, which chronicles his unique experiences at the intersection of law, science, and innovation. Welcome to the podcast, Jorge. So excited to have you with me on the air.
Thank you for having me. I look forward to having an interesting conversation.
Well, I'm really excited about this conversation because you've had an incredible career in IP. So I thought maybe, Jorge, the best way to start the podcast off is to ask you if you wouldn't mind sharing a little bit about your career journey. What drew you to the crossroads of biology and IP law?
Well, I came to the United States from Argentina to study chemistry. And I studied chemistry at RPI and then went for my PhD at Harvard. And I was intent in becoming an organic chemist. But I had a wonderful mentor and thesis advisor, Frank Westheimer, one of the great organic chemists of the 20th century. And when I talked to him about my plans, he listened carefully and then he smiled and he said, you know, organic chemistry is okay, but it's old. The future, Jorge, you say, belongs to biology. And even if you end up being an organic chemist, you should study biology. Take James Watson course on the molecular biology of the gene to get yourself a little basic education in genetics. You never know. And I thought, James Watson? Oh my God, is that the Watson Crick? And he said, yeah, he teaches a three times a week in the bio labs. Go sign up to audit his course and you learn some stuff. And so between that advice and taking the weekly course of Watson on the molecular biology of a gene, my eyes were opened to the future, as Frank Westheimer had predicted. I was, however, not fully aware that as I was doing this and I was going through the motions of getting a PhD in chemistry while also educating myself in biology, there was a great deal of stuff going on in biology. And I did not know, for example, and I'm talking now 71 to 76, which was my PhD time, 70, 71, 72 were the early days of genetic engineering, and Paul Berg in 73 recombined the DNA of two viruses to make a hybrid virus, and Cesar Milstein and George Koehler Berg was in Stanford, and Koehler and Milstein were in the Medical Research Center in Cambridge, England, They invented methods of making monoclonal antibodies in 1976 when I was graduating with my PhD. And frankly, I was not aware of what was going on. And the reason I wasn't aware is because, you know, thesis students anywhere in the world focus on the thesis. They focus on what they have to do to get a PhD and all the intricate details of the molecules I was studying. I was studying enzymes, actually, so it was sort of biological. And then I became sort of disenchanted with doing research at the bench. It was not my temperament. Nobody had said to me that studying and understanding scientific topics like biology, molecular biology, chemistry, was an entirely different thing than being a professional chemist or a professional molecular biologist, a professor, as Frank Westheimer and everybody else in my mentoring groups there wanted me to become. And I suddenly realized I'm not sure I have a temperament of doing research. The issue with research, of course, is it's very slow. There's a lot of trial and error. You could end up with errors that would take years away from your work. And you have to delay your gratification. And I understood that my temperament was not one of delaying gratification. I wanted to do something and get the results. And I started talking with a good friend of mine who was a law student at the Harvard Law School, and Leonard is his name. And Leonard said to me, you know, there is this field called patent law, and I just summered at one of the firms downtown Boston, and I'll introduce you to a partner that knows this stuff and go talk to him. So I went to talk to this partner, and he said to me, he was a great mentor then, that day, really. He said to me, you know, there is this new thing called biotechnology, and I know almost nothing because I'm a chemist, but there is a great deal of future for intellectual property in biotechnology. So the future belonged to biology, according to Frank Westheimer, and to this partner at Ropes and Gray, to intellectual property dealing with biology. And then suddenly in 1980, Chakrabarty was decided. The famous case that said that because an invention is a product that is alive does not mean you cannot get a patent on it. And that just did it for me. And I decided this is the career I want to do. I went to law school. I graduated in 1983. I was working part-time and going to law school part-time at GW. And then Robert Stern, my partner to this day at Stern, Kessler, Goldstein, Fox, and I met in law school, and he wanted to form a law firm that dealt with the high technology of electronics. He was a software connoisseur in electronics and a radio aficionado. And he said, you can bring biology and molecular biology to this farm, and I will do electronics, and both of us will ride the wave of the future. So I had a lot of good mentors who told me what the future was going to look like, and they all turned out to be right, and I wasn't so prescient as they were. But it came to be in the last few years, or right now in the 2000s, 2010s, that I suddenly realized, oh my God, I was there at the inception. I was there when things were starting, and I should write a book about it. So that takes us all the way from my scientific work, my legal work, which was the intervening 40 years, 40 plus years, all the way to writing this book that we're talking about.
So, Jorge, given this incredible career that you were at the beginning of the biotech revolution, at the beginning of the formation of CERN Kessler, what were some of the most formative experiences earlier in your career that set you on the path to becoming one of the leading IP attorneys in life sciences?
Yes. I realized very early on when I decided to become an IP lawyer that biotechnology was very new and most experienced lawyers, the ones with gray hairs, like I do now, understood chemistry and understood pharmaceuticals and chemical processes and things like polymers, et cetera, et cetera. And they knew the jargon because they understood that the world was changing, but they did not really have a good foundation in molecular biology. In contrast, the CEOs and the founders of the startups, and I'm now talking Genentech and Amgen and Genetics Institute, Kaiwan, all companies with whom I interviewed, some of whom offered me jobs. But I decided I wanted to form a firm and not be a corporate counsel. So the CEOs, the founders of these biotech companies were generally young. They had come out of labs relatively recently. And so they were looking for lawyers that knew what was going on and understood it and didn't just know the jargon. So that helped me from a pitching point of view to convince them that it's okay. I didn't have gray hairs. I only had maybe a year or two or three of experience. But hey, put me in a room with your top scientist and tell her to explain to me what she's doing, and I can have a conversation. And that was a lot of what was going on in my discussions with them to start sending me work. I was very lucky that I had one superb mentor, and his name is Marvin Guthrie. Marvin Guthrie was the head of technology transfer at the Massachusetts General Hospital. In those years, the Mass General Hospital had just received funding from Hoechst in Germany to create a Department of Molecular Biology. And he said to me, I think you need to come to Boston from Washington at least twice a month and start talking to all these scientists that are now charged with developing molecular biology work. And so I had the privilege of not just talking to some of them, and these are folks that eventually went on to get Nobel Prizes and so on and so forth, but Marvin Guthrie, who was a magnificent attorney, understood the delicate nature of academic industry relations and ended up being one of the founders of the Society of University Patent Administrators, now known as AUTUM, of course, as you know, and as our listeners probably know. So Marvin Guthrie mentored me in many, many different aspects. He let me talk when it came to the IP of molecular biology, but I listened to him when it came to dealing with scientists, dealing with larger-than-life personalities at the MGH. I mean, the MGH was the teaching hospital of the Harvard Medical School at the time, and most of the professors thought that they were God's gift to medicine. But I learned diplomacy because they may have been God's gift to medicine, and many of them were, but intellectual property was my domain. So it was fun. And I will always have a corner of my heart for Marvin. Marvin eventually left the Mass General. He and I became partners, and he is now living in Oregon in full retirement. So having mentorship like that and having early experiences with top-of-the-line scientists and molecular biologists was a really formative experience, and I credit a lot of my ability to then attract folks that were in similarly situated, but in companies, Everybody was, at the time, I remember this clearly, and this was the late 70s, middle to late 80s. Everybody was looking for folks who understood molecular biology and intellectual property. And it's not that I knew the intellectual property of molecular of biotechnology. We were creating it as we were going along. But at least I knew basic IP and I knew the science. And so that combination opened many, many doors, many, many doors.
It really does sound like it. It certainly did. So Jorge, I want to turn now to your book, which you've mentioned a couple of times, Patenting Life. And it's really an incredible book because it offers a front row seat to some of the landmark IP battles. What inspired you to write this book and who did you envision as your audience?
Well, I've noted previously that I came to realize about 10, 12 years ago, as I was thinking about my career in law, in IP law specifically, that I had been present at the inception of the mix of molecular biology and intellectual property law, and that I had consciously or not, or knowingly or not, been part of that beginning. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to tell a little bit about the history of biotechnology, commercial biotechnology, the new biology, as I call it, how it became commercialized, how people started thinking about monetizing inventions in the new biology. And by that, I mean both genetics and monoclonal antibodies and modern immunology, from somebody who was there and who fought some of the early battles. And I had published a whole bunch of articles in law, even some early ones in science, but I had many publications and hundreds of presentations in the area of biotech patent law and intellectual property law. And I also have always had an interest in improving my writing. And so I took a number of writing courses at the Writers' Center in Bethesda, Maryland, a great place. And then we formed, together with friends, a writer's circle, which tested ideas on how to write complicated things. There was a not scientist, but there was a journalist who was writing a novel. There is still the curator from the Smithsonian who is writing his memoir, another attorney in environmental law that's writing a story of the Montreal Protocol. And we all wrote chapters, sections, and at one point I said, how about if I start working on a history of biotech told through intellectual property? And it was this group that then forced me to write in plain English, in the first person, not in the passive voice, short sentences, and kept me on the straight and narrow so that my writing would start becoming less wooden than it had been when I was a scientist. You know what it means to write science. And then superimposed on that was the legal jargon and legal training that I received. So you superimpose science and law, and the result is passive voice, long sentences, full of jargon and acronyms. And I slowly but surely started shedding it. And then it occurred to me to make it really friendly to a general audience. And a general audience for me is somebody who is at least interested or curious about the natural world, maybe about the social world and how the two interact, how law slowly develops, at least the common law in the United States, slowly develops precedents so that every new case gets looked at and analyzed and then tried to accommodate into general theories that little by little emerge. And I decided the way to do this would be to write important cases and important developments, not just case law, but also important developments through the individuals that I met and who I got to know with whom I had interactions over the years. So I thought, why don't I write a book where pretty much every chapter is the story of a human being? After all, case law, every case at the end of the day has a human story to it. An inventor, an entrepreneur, a judge, a scientist, a venture capitalist. And that's what I decided to do. So I've written the book based on people. Judge Lurie at the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit figures very prominently because he was involved in some of the really early battles on eligibility. I have stories of creative scientists like Steve Hoffman, about whom I talk at length in one chapter about his invention of a malaria vaccine. Very creative entrepreneurs who were also products of the biotech, the new biotech era, such as Mark Rodman, who was a physician at Columbia Medical School, as well as a superb entrepreneur who focused on genetic diagnostics. Colleagues of mine, like Eldora Ellison, who is one of the top biotech IP lawyers in the country today. Opponents like Jim Haley, who used to be a partner of Fish and Neve and now has his own firm. And so through them and the cases that we had in common or where we were against each other or where the judge decided something one way or the other, I decided I'd write this book. And it flowed very well. And people who read it, who are not lawyers and who are not scientists, have given me lots of feedback about how interesting it is and how I've made it approachable to them and how much they've enjoyed it. And I also decided I wasn't going to dumb anything down. I was going to explain the science like a lawyer arguing in front of a judge or a jury or a court of appeals, describing even very hard stuff like the CRISPR gene editing technology or the concept of biological deposits as escrows or the legal concept of enablement with similes or metaphors or analogies. And I would take my time and I would get into the details. For that, I was inspired by Thomas Mann. Thomas Mann famously said when he wrote The Magic Mountain, the German writer who won the Nobel Prize in 1929, that only thoroughness can be truly entertaining. So I decided I would be very thorough, very detailed, but I would do this in plain English. And I think the results, you know, it's turned out pretty good.
I agree with you. It's a very thorough book, but it's very approachable and readable. And, you know, that leads me to want to ask you, Jorge, is there one story from the book in particular that stands out to you as both instructive and maybe emblematic of the broader themes in biotech patent law?
I think that one of the most fascinating stories in the development of biotech patent law were the eligibility battles that were fought surrounding patents on isolated human genes. This was a case that went on for many, many years, and it pitted Myriad Genetics that have patents on isolated BRCA1, BRCA2 genes. These are genes that in their mutated form cause breast cancer and other cancers. And so diagnosing the presence of the mutations in men or women, but primarily women, gives you the ability to say whether this person is at risk of developing breast cancer. And the patents went on for quite a while, Myriad Genetics had essentially taken over the field. They were not even allowing second opinions. So the industry was not happy with these patents. And I had myself prepared and filed many patent applications on isolated genes, including isolated genes that came out of the Mass General Hospital labs that I discussed before. Like Jim Guzzella isolated the gene for Huntington's disease. And Francis Collins of the NIH, when he was at Michigan, had isolated the gene for cystic fibrosis and figured out mutation 508 was the one that was causing it. So I was very familiar with isolated genes. And I thought, because an isolated gene is separated from the genome, from where it is essentially embedded, and it is embedded by what organic chemists call covalent bonds. Covalent bonds are very strong bonds, and organic chemists figured out all kinds of ways of breaking and making covalent bonds to create new compositions of matter and new molecules, etc. And because taking a gene out of the genome of a complete string of DNA that we're all formed of, each one of our cells, would make a new molecule, namely a molecule that was no longer covalently bonded to the rest of the long chain of DNA, that this was novel, and because it was novel, it would also be eligible for patents. And so we all filed and obtained patents on isolated genes in those years. And I'm talking 1980, 1990, the early aughts, and Myriad Genetics had their share. And then the Association of Molecular Pathology decided to challenge the whole notion of getting isolated genes and challenged the decision, the patents as not eligible for patenting. And it went through the district court in New York, and the district court agreed with them. And the district court said, breaking covalent bonds, what's the big deal? It's still the same gene, so no, it's not eligible. And we were all shocked. I could tell you 90% of the biotech patent attorneys in the 2000s looked at that decision, including me, saying, oh, this judge.
Me too, yeah.
He doesn't understand chemistry. He doesn't know this is a new material.
Exactly.
It's novel, right? And the section of the statute that deals with eligibility, which is Section 101, says anybody can get a patent on any novel and useful composition of matter. So novel was enough for all of us. And the decision from the judge in New York went to the Federal Circuit. The Court of Appeals Federal Circuit has ultimate jurisdiction, not ultimate, but has exclusive jurisdiction on patent matters, including eligibility matters. And Judge Lurie was a prominent organic chemist, well-trained scientist, who headed the panel that looked at this decision from the judge in New York. And he wrote a treatise on eligibility. And he said the covalent bond is what's broken. And once you break a covalent bond, the isolated gene is a new composition of matter, and it's therefore eligible. And we all sighed a sigh of relief, and we all concluded, see, this judge in New York didn't know what he was doing. But of course, the Association of Molecular Pathology went up to the Supreme Court, which is the ultimate arbiter of patent law. And the Supreme Court took on the case, much to everybody's surprise. And the Supreme Court, in a unanimous decision written by Justice Thomas, went through molecular biology. And I thought I was sitting in Watson's course again with all the details about DNA and nucleotides and covalent bonds and non-covalent bonds and double helices and on and on and on. And they agreed with a judge in New York. And they wrote their own treatise on how to interpret the patent law. And Judge Lurie at the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, who was my hero, because he, I mean, I thought that whatever Judge Lurie says is, in fact, the law, ended up not quite being right. And we learned that the Supreme Court, because of the Supreme Court thinking in much broader terms than just novelty, they decided that novelty does not necessarily equal eligibility, and that you could have something novel, like an isolated gene, or even maybe a purified product of nature, like a molecule from a tree in the Amazon. And just because it's isolated or purified doesn't mean that you can get a patent on it. They focus on a part of the statute that talks about invents, that says whoever invents a novel and useful product of nature can get a patent. And they said, don't forget that it says invents. So there has to be something that has been invented. And breaking covalent bonds is not inventing anything. And it doesn't matter that it took him forever to find where this gene was, the BRCA gene was. That may have been superb, and maybe it's inventive and non-obvious, but that doesn't mean that you can get a patent on it. And that changed the whole paradigm, because what followed were a whole series of decisions on what does it mean to invent. And in a way, it portended what's happening today, and I hope I'll talk about that with you a little later on concerning artificial intelligence. Who is inventing? What does it mean to invent something? And so the dialogue changed from, well, if it's novel, it's eligible, to has something been invented here? And that doesn't mean whether it's obvious or not obvious, inventive or not inventive under another section of the law, which is obviousness law, but it means, has something been invented? And so now we all live under the AMP, the Myriad Genetics law, as expanded in detail by Justice Thomas, that we need to think beyond novelty. And I thought that the tension between the decisions written by Judge Lurie and the decision written by the Supreme Court was so dramatic, you know, they reached completely opposite results, that I think for me it stays as a symbol of what was going on in those years. This is fundamental stuff that we today take for granted, but it wasn't always taken for granted. And there were a lot of people who thought Lurie was right. And then we were all surprised when the Supreme Court said, no, he's not right. And of course, we all had to get used to it, but that was part of that ferment, that intellectual ferment that everybody was involved in those years. And I'm talking all the way from 1980s to the mid-aughts, 2020 or so, 2010 or so.
2010, yeah, because there was a series of three decisions. There were the Prometheus, then there was the Myriad Genetics, and then, of course, there was Alice. And I was with you. I thought Judge Lurie was correct, but here we are today still dealing with those the three cases right in a row by the Supreme Court on Section 101.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's wreaked havoc in like diagnostics and other industries. So, Jorge, I wanted to ask you, share with us a little bit, if you wouldn't mind, some of your experience working on some landmark cases that fundamentally shifted the patent landscape for biotechnology.
Yeah, I mean, I worked not directly on the Myriad Genetics AMP litigation, although I followed it at great detail. And a funny anecdote I tell in the book is that I went to the hearing at the Supreme Court in Washington, and James Watson, my famous professor from way back, had written an amicus brief in the AMP Myriad case. And he said very clearly in that brief, you can't get a patent on a gene, especially if all you do is just claim it by sequence. A gene is the blueprint for human life and animal life and vegetable life and It's much more than just an isolated sequence. And I saw, and I was interested to see whether he'd show up. He showed up. I walked over to him. He looked at me like a wise old man, and he said, "Oh, it's so nice to see you again." I learned that from him. I say that to everybody.
Too funny.
I'm sure he didn't remember me at all, but still, it was nice to shake his hand. And he was, of course, right. DNA is not just a molecule, it's information. And that is the basic lesson of AMP v. Myriad Genetics. But I was involved in litigation involving Mark Grockman's company, GeneDx. It got sued by Myriad Genetics. And so we put together a defense based on now the new law saying a lot of these patents, they may not have gone up to the Supreme Court, but they are zombies. They're walking dead. And we eventually won that case because eventually Myriad Genetics' lawyer called me and said, "Okay, we're going to settle it." I thought, what took you so long? But okay, they did. The main case, I think, that I'd love to think is my mark on the law is in Re Wands. It's a case that deals with the concept of enablement of broad claims. So if you have a patent claim to a single antibody, that's a narrow claim, almost a picture claim. On the other hand, if you have a claim that covers dozens, hundreds, thousands, perhaps, or maybe even an indefinite number of antibodies, that's called a genus claim. And having support in the patent application as written, together with whatever the skill of the art is at the time, for the entire genus of antibodies, which may be an indeterminate large number, was a problem. And the Patent Office of the United States was insisting that the problem be solved by making biological deposits of a series of antibodies that somehow exemplified those that were claimed. And I had a case, Jack Wan's case, before the patent office with an examiner. Her name was Margaret Moskowitz. I remember her well. And she kept insisting, you have one deposit. One deposit of an antibody isn't going to enable, as we call it in law, fully put in possession of the public the full scope of this genus, and you need to make more antibodies. And I said to her, "Well, Ms. Moskowitz, how many? How many do you want me to make? Oh, that's up for you to decide." I said, "Look, I can't, and I will not make any more deposits. And I will take this case to the Patent Office Appeal Board. And if they say they agree with you, I will take this case to the Court of Appeals." And her response was, "Yes, please do that. We don't know how to deal with the issue of broad claims in the patent office. And this is a perfect case to test whether deposits will do it or whether something else will do it." And I was surprised. And I talked to the chief of biotech examination at the time, and he confirmed that they wanted this case to go up to the Court of Appeals. And the board affirmed the patent office, so the rejection for lack of enablement still stood, and we went up to the Court of Appeals. This was the Mass General Hospital. Jack Wands was a hepatology specialist, and this was a test for hepatitis B, a diagnostic test, and it used these monoclonal antibodies that had been invented by Milstein and Koehler in 1975. So we're talking now the mid-80s, 10 years earlier. So we went up to the Federal Circuit, and I argued on behalf of the Mass General Hospital, and the Solicitor General of the Patent Office argued on behalf of the Patent Office. And I presented my case There were several questions from the panel, I remember. And then the solicitor gets up and he says, you know, one deposit is not going to do it here. This is a very broad claim. And I held my breath. And Judge Pauline Newman, who is still on the court, even though many of her colleagues thinks she should not longer be on the court.
Yeah, exactly.
But Judge Newman asked questions, said, well, solicitor, tell me how many deposits should ones make 10 deposits, 100 deposits, 1,000 deposits? Is there no end? I mean, this claim does not have a limit to the number. It's not like 20 antibodies where ones knows to make 20 deposits. How many? And I looked at my co-counsel and I said, I think we have just won this case. This was the question I was hoping somebody would ask because there is no answer. And the solicitor hemmed and hawed and he said, well, it depends. And Judge Newman said, depends on what? Doesn't the Patent Office want this case to be a test that will set forth a basic rule? So how could we send this case back and say it depends unless you give us some guidance? And she stopped giving him a hard time, and he sat down, and I got up and I said, I have no further rebuttal, thank you. I sat down. I've learned over the years when there's nothing to say, it's better not to say anything. So the decision came down a few months later. It was not written by Newman. Actually, she dissented in once, in a 2-1. But the decision was, and her dissent had nothing to do with the number of deposits, the decision came down and gave us what are today known as the 8 ones factors that have to be analyzed. They're facts. They are issues that have to do with what is the level of skill, how much is in the specification, are there any examples, how broad are the claims. These sort of things are queries that the patent office, the examiners, the judges have to make when they're analyzing enablement. No issue of deposits. Deposits are gone. That was the issue that took it up to the Court of Appeals, but it's not the issue in ones anymore. And ones has survived. It has been cited probably thousands of times. It even survived a recent decision from the Supreme Court called Amgen v. Sanofi, you know about it.
Yep.
And Amgen v. Sanofi made things more complicated because while there was screening involved in looking for antibodies that could do the immunoassay for the hepatitis test in ones, and that seemed to be acceptable, which ones bind? In Amgen v. Sanofi, there was the issue was different. It went up to the Supreme Court, and the issue was not just which antibodies bind to a particular molecule, but will also bring about a therapeutic effect, like blocking the LDL receptor, which leads to problems with cholesterol. And the Supreme Court said, you know, screening for biological activity is very different than what Wands was doing in 1988. And we just find that Amgen has not given us, even if you look at the 8 ones factors, enough to support the enablement of this pretty open-ended claim that covers an indeterminate number of antibodies. So it has survived, ones has survived Amgen v. Sanofi, and I think it could be distinguished. I have written on it. Last year, I wrote a paper, 2024, on how to deal with the Amgen v. Sanofi enablement issue. But it was not my case, although we've represented Amgen over the years, not in the Sanofi case. And I think ones is perhaps the one I'm proudest of because it's survived and it's good. And everybody knows about the ones factors who works in biotech patent or even the chemists use them now. And Jack Ones sadly passed away in 2023. Before Patenting Life was published, I had sent him a copy of his chapter where I described this, and he said, I will buy 10 books ahead of time.
Oh,
and I said,
no.
By all means, sure. And he ended up passing away, and his grandson, who loved him dearly, called me, told me that he had passed away, and could he still have the 10 books? And I said, of course. And I dedicated the book to Jack Wands. And because the Wands factors are so famous, and the case that has his name was called Inre Wands, I would sometimes jokingly not call him Jack, but I would call him Inre.
You would call him Inre. That's hilarious.
How are you, Inre?
How are you, Inre? Oh, that's too funny. You know, Jorge, I want to ask you about another significant patent dispute that you've been involved in, and that's the CRISPR-Cas9 patent battle between the University of California, University of Vienna, and Emmanuel Charpentier against Broad, MIT, and Harvard. Can you walk us through a little bit your experience in representing the UC team and what made this case so complex and high stakes?
By the way, it's still complex and high stakes.
Yeah, it still is all over the world.
It isn't over.
Yeah, not by a long shot. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's not over. And I should say, first of all, that I was part of a large team of international lawyers who fought the CRISPR prosecution battles in Europe and who fought a patent application interference in the United States, and who eventually took the case to the Court of Appeals. And these include people like Eldora Ellison, who I mentioned earlier, my partner, who is the lead counsel in the interference, and Jeff Lampkin of Molo Lampkin, who is a superb appellate lawyer, who got the loss at the PTO reversed. So that's why we are now back at the PTO. The case, it has it all.
Yeah, it definitely does.
No. And it's only in the United States, because I think the patent situation in Europe and in other countries in the world is controlled by who files first. In the US, until the America Invents Act in 2012, we had a first to invent system, and we have now abandoned the system. So this is a legacy interference, as they're called. An interference is a battle for priority between two patent applicants that file patent applications at about the same time. And the interference laws for many, many years were such that you might have filed second, and you may have very well lost the patent rights in Europe or in Japan, but in the US, you could prove that you had invented first. And that involves a process. Invention is a little bit of conception. Actually, it's all about complete conception of the invention, of the common invention between the two parties, followed by a reduction to practice, namely demonstration that it works for its intended purpose, either by carrying out experiments, and these could be weeks later, months later, or by filing a complete patent application. That's called the constructive reduction to practice. So interferences are very much about who invented first. In fact, they're very much about who conceived of the invention first. And so the law is such that conception is a very iffy proposition, because it's in the mind of a scientist. It is sometimes written down in detail. Sometimes it's not written down in detail, but it comes along with a whole bunch of additional elements, such as, for example, did the scientist know for sure that the conception could be reduced to practice and that it would work for its intended purpose? And how diligent was she in going from conception to reduction to practice? Or did she abandon and then only woke up when she saw that her opponent had filed a case? So it's a complicated business. For many, many years, I knew interference law and regulations and fought many, many interferences. I won my share, I lost my share, but interferences were very much part of what I was able to do. Now, To complicate matters, because legally it's complicated to prove conception and that the conception has not been abandoned and that the conception looks like it was eventually reduced to practice without further changes, without further inventions, that it sort of correlates with what was reduced to practice. With the science is quite complicated. It has to do with gene editing and a system, which is the CRISPR system, that is primarily involved with two types of molecules, RNA molecules and an enzyme, a protein. And the enzyme clips the DNA double helix. It opens it up and then clips one of the strands. So it's a nuclease enzyme of some sort. And the RNA associates with this enzyme. The enzyme is called Cas9, and basically leads the enzyme to that piece of DNA with which the RNA will hybridize or will form a double string. And then once that has been formed at the right spot, the enzyme clips it, and then you could put in another gene, or you could take a gene out and put a new gene in. So this was originally seen as a way to modify DNA, and that leads immediately to treating genetic diseases, congenital diseases, sickle cell anemia, inherited deafness, and on and on and on. And it just opened up the floodgates for commercialization of a technology that promises and still promises to be a lifesaver for many, many people. And it has proven technologically to be right. Just about 3-4 months ago, there was a baby that was born in Philadelphia with a very serious congenital disease that might have killed them within about a year or two, couldn't make a particular enzyme that was critical. And they did a very, very careful but quickly developed CRISPR experiment, and the enzyme has appeared, and the baby is on recovery. So it's real, and it is earth-shaking. And the press, so that's the third thing. It became public very quickly, and the press has a field day talking about how magnificent this medicine development is. And then, of course, there is a big fight between scientists at the University of California and the University of Vienna. These are two women, Jennifer Doudna, who are clients of ours, and Emmanuel Charpentier, the latter of Vienna, and Jennifer of the University of California, who argued that they were the first to conceive and that they gave the basic idea of how to put all of this together and what was necessary, put it into the public domain. And then a colleague of Professor Zheng, who is a top scientist in genetics and mammalian cell biology at the Broad Institute of Harvard and MIT, quickly saw what was going on and reduced it to practice before Doudna Charpentier reduced it to practice. And then he reduced it to practice in very complicated cells called eukaryotes and filed a patent application before they had reduced it to practice, claiming that he was the inventor of CRISPR in eukaryotic cells. And the patent office gave Zhang the patent, and we jumped and said, wait, it's not so simple. Doudna Charpentier invented it in all organisms. They simply did not reduce it to practice in eukaryotes, but so what? Their conception was complete. The problem for Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier was that they gave interviews to the press, especially the science press, where they said, like good, honest scientists, especially Jennifer Doudna, well, you know, you're never sure whether something's going to work until you actually prove it. But that's the way it is in biology. You know, you could say this is going to work. I don't think there's any problem in reducing this to practice in eukaryotes. I've shown that it works in simpler organisms like microbes that don't have a nuclear membrane, don't have RNases, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't see any problem. Well, of course, what they all focused on was that she said she wasn't sure. And that was used by Zhang saying her conception was not complete. So it was a mix of top-of-the-line world-changing science and medicine, Nobel Prize winning to the two ladies, a complicated legal interference, and her own admissions. They were used as admissions that she wasn't sure whether something would work or not, and an enormous number of folks who were funding this. After all, this is a battle legally between the University of California and the University of Vienna, and Charpentier on her own that has retained some rights. On the one side, all academicians against Professor Zhang, also a top academician at Harvard and MIT and the Broad Institute. And the press had nothing more interesting to say than these two big universities are fighting against each other. These are all federally funded inventions. Why don't you guys just settle it? So there were these four or five major factors that have caused CRISPR to become a cause célèbre. And the Patent Office of the United States, in the interference that was declared on eukaryotic CRISPR, agreed with Yang and with Harvard, Broad, and MIT, and against the University of California, even though, of course, the University of California scientists and Charpentier had won the Nobel Prize. It didn't seem to make any difference. And maybe it shouldn't make any difference. We made an argument that these were Nobel Prize winning inventions and the world had recognized. But of course, the law is very different. The law focuses on evidence. What is in the record? When did she reduce to practice? How come she expressed doubt? And the law, the way the Patent Office interpreted it, favored Zhang. And so we took the case to the Court of Appeals. And it was argued brilliantly, I should say, by Jeff Lamkin of Moller Lamkin, an appellate lawyer. And then the Court of Appeals sat on it for a year. And we were all going, why is this taking so long?
It took forever, yes.
No. And we were all thinking, you know, these decisions usually get decided within 6 months or so. What's going on? What's going on? Everybody was a little nervous. And then the Federal Circuit decided and handed down the decision earlier in the spring of this year and said, basically, the Patent Office did not understand the law well and made a big legal mistake in giving so much weight to the fact that the inventor was not sure whether this would reduce to practice easily or not. And they said, it doesn't matter that the inventor has doubts. The test is an objective test. If the conception is complete and can be handed over to a person of ordinary skill in the art, then the conception is complete. If it has not changed between the conception and the reduction to practice, there has been no need for further inventions, for major changes. Or the conception is not quite the same, but by the reduction to practice, it had changed and it was, you know, the way she had conceived it originally wouldn't work anymore. Then maybe the conception was not stable and permanent. So they focused on permanence, not on uncertainty, and send it back to the Patent Office saying, okay, this is the correct legal test. Get it right this time. Look at all the evidence and tell us whether the conception was definitive, permanent, stable, and whether anybody of skill in the art could have reduced it to practice without making further inventions. And the evidence we put in below at the patent office included reductions to practice by 5 or 6 groups internationally within a few months. And we said, well, that proves that there was nothing major that still had to be done. And the court never resolved it, said, okay, go back to the judge in the patent office and tell us who wins. So we're now, no, we're all holding our breaths again. But that's where we are.
Yeah, it's a waiting game again. So we'll see what happens. And
I know.
It's going to be fascinating to watch regardless. So Jorge, I want to switch gears a little bit and ask you about what trends in research commercialization you're paying special attention to today, especially as synthetic biology and gene editing become more and more prominent.
Yeah, you know, my main concerns have less to do with synthetic biology and gene editing. I will tell you that I am a little concerned about artificial intelligence and its uses on inventing drugs, which are happening left and right, and how people are going to be able to protect this, because artificial intelligence is not considered to be an inventor, even though it's pretty clear that artificial intelligence can conceive of new uses for old drugs, repurposing of drugs, even the design of new synthetic proteins. We have recently gone through a biological revolution in the understanding of how proteins work and how they fold from being just a linear chain of amino acids to a little globule, three-dimensional, that works like an enzyme or whatever. And all of that was done with artificial intelligence. And the Nobel Prize was won by a combination of biologists at the University of Washington and a Google scientist who did AI 2 years ago, a year ago. That is a headache for patent lawyers. And I think it is clear that biotechnology is moving more and more into artificial molecules, artificial living organisms, by creation de novo or even mutations and so on, and creating commercial protection with a 20-year patent may or may not be possible, because the law generally is that only a human being can be an inventor or a co-inventor. So I'm in the process of writing a paper on AI as co-inventor. And will this pass muster or not? And I think my recommendation will be, this is a preview of my conclusion, that the Congress should change the law and allow AI to contribute to conceptions, be co-inventors or plain inventors. What matters at the end is who controls the patent rights, and who conceived it is not that important. This goes back to our early patent law, where individuals working in their own basements or laboratories mattered. Today, you know, with the advent of AI, all of that model has changed and the law needs to adapt. So I think I consider, from a legal point of view, that to be the cutting edge. One of the big cutting edge issues is, what role will AI play, and how is the patent law going to avoid this need to have only human beings invent? I think that needs to be changed, and it can only be changed by a law of Congress. But those are my legal scientific concerns. I think that's for the next generation of young lawyers. When they ask me, what should I worry about? I said, worry about AI. No, what I'm worried about, Lisa, is what's going on with our country right now. And it has a major impact on the biotech industry. And I've mentioned a number of things in the book that since the advent of the new administration have now dramatically changed. I talk at length in the book about the collaborations between federally funded universities and the block and the platforms and the basic fundamental biology that they have always discovered, and the transfer of that into a company that can then make a product that can be sold in the marketplace. And the patent system is crucial for that. But if federal funding of universities in the United States will be curtailed, as it seems to be, then a lot of basic discoveries are not going to be made in the U.S. and they're going to be made abroad. There is a clear invitation by our friends in China and our friends in France and on to invite American scientists to just emigrate and go put their labs in a place where they will be welcome and they will have funding. And I left Argentina when I was young because I couldn't see a future as a scientist then in studying chemistry or biology or whatever. And American scientists are now put into the same problem of not seeing how they're going to fund their lab, how discoveries are going to be made. And so there is going to be, I'm afraid, an American brain drain. And that is very sad. I also talk at length about the ecosystems between universities, academia in general, startup companies, venture capital groups, big pharma, in taking basic discoveries to the marketplace. And again, if basic discoveries are not made, the whole ecosystem, which is represented in general by clusters, you know, of these entities in Boston, Silicon Valley, et cetera, is going to disappear. Then I heard recently that the Bayh-Dole Act, which Autumn is pretty much a pillar of, right, and uses to explain why it's good to have ownership of patents in universities, even while the inventions have been made with federal funds, that the Bayh-Dole Act, which for many years have been tried to be used by mostly very progressive legislators like Elizabeth Warren, Ocasio-Cortez, Bernie Sanders, and others on the left to try to control the prices of drugs through what are known as marching rights. Marching rights are essentially the right of the government to take away patents that have been obtained with federal funds if the university is not making the products commercially available. And the NIH has always said, when there's been applications for marching rights, no, we're not the right agency to control drug prices in the United States. You may want to go somewhere else. We don't want to get into this. And that was a uniform answer, whether the NIH director had been appointed by one side of the aisle or the other side of the aisle. Well, much to my shock, about 3 weeks ago, the present government announced that it would threaten to use marching rights under the Bayh-Dole Act against Harvard as a way to take away patents from Harvard. And it is clearly a way to gain leverage over Harvard, to get Harvard to do what the government wants. It is part of a big lawsuit that Harvard's filed against the federal government. And it is essentially sort of a way to use marching rights, not to decrease the price of drugs, but to gain leverage against an opponent in litigation, which is far from where the marching right is intended to be used. So that is another scary proposition. And it's interesting that now, you know, the left and the right are sort of united in looking at marching rights.
Yeah, exactly. But whoever thought they would take this weird turn?
Especially this weird turn, and for entirely different reasons. And then the other thing that's going on is an attack on vaccines, an attack on mRNA vaccines. I talk at great length about the great mRNA vaccines that helped stop the COVID pandemic and saved many millions of lives around the world. And the fight about them was, are they enough accessible to the developing world? And what are we doing to make sure that everybody gets vaccinated, not just us rich folks up here in the North? Well, and now we have a government that doesn't even think that vaccines are so good. Not to talk about mRNA, they recently canceled 20 contracts dealing with mRNA vaccines, completely undermining years of excellent science and efficacy. And the last overriding thing is I worry about generating distrust in data that's generated by the government. So the government issues economic data, and we've already seen that the government doesn't like some of the numbers, and so they want to get rid of people that issue the numbers that they don't like. And it's pretty clear, too, that the government, this government, doesn't like issues dealing with climate change. And so weather data will probably be adjusted up or down, depending on what the government wants. Data on health and disease, you know, vaccination, lack of vaccination, is it or not correlated with the appearance of measles epidemics in Texas? It's pretty scary to me. I've seen this movie before in Latin America. When the government doesn't like data and doesn't support education and universities, it could really set the United States, a country that is mine, and I love it and have adopted it, by a generation. And it may or may not be possible to recover. So I'm just sounding the alarm, but I'm not the only one sounding the alarm.
Yeah, there's a lot of people sounding the alarm right now, and it's going to be very, very interesting to see what happens the next few weeks and months here. But yeah, that was a great summary of everything going on for sure. So Jorge, I wanted to ask you, looking back, which moments in your career do you find most rewarding or maybe surprising?
Yeah, well, certainly in Rwanda, I can't help it. Ones and how it's been interpreted and interpreted and interpreted over the years, and how it's held up with the 8-1s factors, and how it's being used by courts left and right and by the patent office left and right. And the patent office in 24 said, keep using it. It's good. It's a good way to look at broad scope claims. So I think that perhaps is my most rewarding impact on the case law and on the whole biotech case law. I'm also very happy and proud of the fact that this firm that we formed with Stern in the late 70s, early 80s, has gone from 3 or 4 people to about 400, 500 people now. And we are still, I think, I may say so, even though I'm a founder and a partner, considered to be among, you know, the stellar firms in intellectual property of high technology. So seeing the growth of the law firm and making sure that it transcended me and Rob Stern's presence there, and that it became institutional, and that it wasn't just a founder's folly that we wanted to create something, and then when we're gone, it's gone. But that there are multiple generations that have taken up the mantle and have carried the firm forward to what it is today. That is something I'm very, very proud of. I have trained generations of smart biotech patent lawyers, whether they are with us or have gone on to form their own law firms or have gone on to companies. I've written a book that is used both by beginners and experienced practitioners called United States Biotech Patent Law, which is a scholarly, more sort of casebook, hornbook type book that explains the law. It's very different than patenting life. It's written in legalese with dense jargon. But it is for lawyers, and that's in its 10th edition. I've now been publishing it with Thomson Reuters for 10 years in a row. And I think seeing small startups benefit from the patent system has been a joy also for me. I think startups are the ideal clients and universities too, for a good solid patent system. Big Pharma is of two minds. Big Pharma, and I've seen many of them and I've represented many of them, but when they look at what they do, they see themselves primarily as not so much basic research on what's going on, but associating with somebody that has done the research, like a university or a startup, and then taking the IP rights and developing them into a specific drug. And if that drug is successful, they don't need broad generic scope claims. They just need one patent that covers that drug, and then let them compete with anybody else. And the market power that the big pharmaceutical companies have speaks for itself. And so helping the startup get a beachhead and develop intellectual property that can then be leveraged into final products that are going to be done by the big pharma companies, not by the startups, that has been one of the great joys, seeing them from being nothing but an idea to a few people, a CEO from a university, and then helping them negotiate licenses and seeing drugs come into the marketplace based on ideas that were generated 10, 12 years ago and protected has been one of my joys in the profession. So yeah, I'm pretty happy how it went.
Yeah, I would say so. It's been an amazing career that you've had, and this has been an incredible discussion. And so before I let you go, I wanted to ask you, for young professionals entering this field, what skills or mindset do you believe are essential for success at the intersection of science and IP?
I think that a good, smart, dynamic intellectual property lawyer, specifically maybe a patent lawyer in biotechnology, should have two things that they look at constantly. One is the changing law. I think I made my case in talking to you that the law could change overnight, that what we all believe one day may be not quite the case the next day. And all it takes is a few words from the Supreme Court and the law has changed. And so understanding where the law is, why it came to where it is, and how vulnerable it is to changes and where it is perhaps going is critical. And that is important whether the patent lawyer is a prosecuting attorney writing patent applications and going to the patent office, or a litigating attorney, whether in court at the International Trade Commission or at the Court of Appeals or at the Supreme Court. The law is the law, and understanding the law will make every lawyer a better claim drafter, for example, or a better claim challenger, or a better claim defender. It's all about the claims and knowing how the courts interpret the claims in the many, many different angles that go into interpreting claims is critical, and staying up to date is critical. And I think remembering that at the end of the day, no matter how many PhDs you have or postdocs you have, clients hire you because you're a lawyer. You may understand their language, you may understand what they're doing. You might be able to write great patent applications for them, but they don't hire patent lawyers to be scientists. They hire lawyers to be lawyers. And so I always tell even the most glorious PhDs that come to us, you're a lawyer now, or you will soon be, and that's why they hire you. They don't hire you because you're a PhD from MIT or Caltech in glycoproteins. They hire you because you're a lawyer that understands glycoproteins. It's quite different. And that sometimes it's not quite easy to fully understand because, of course, PhDs have just worked very hard to get their degrees and now they're at the bottom of the totem pole when it comes to law. And I unfortunately need to remind them of that every now and then. So that's number one. And the other one is follow what's going on in the science and technology, because When I started, biotech was new, and it was an incredible opportunity to jump on this wave and surf it, and I haven't fallen off the board yet, and see it develop and so on. But it has granularized, really, and it is now so many different subfields. And shortly after I started working, nanotechnology came into being, nanobiotechnology. Then stem cells came into being. Then humanizing and chimerizing monoclonal antibodies came into being. Then conjugating antibodies came into being. Now we're doing cancer therapy with cancer antigen-presenting cells, CAR-T, it's called. And so keep up with the technology because, A, whatever you have become an expert on scientifically may be obsolete in a few years, and you better keep up with what's going on and make sure that you catch the next wave. So there's always a next best thing just over the horizon. I think today, for example, it's artificial intelligence inventing new drugs or new novel synthetic proteins. And there will be battles there. There will be battles about inventorship. There will be battles about obviousness. There will be battles about prior art that has been written down but never reduced to practice. You know, forget interferences. They're gone. There's only one or two left. So focus on the future is my advice. And the future is both where is the law going and where is the science going? And find your niche in wherever you go. Make a niche of yourself in being the go-to in the law firm that understands, you know, humanized monoclonal antibodies and their therapies or whatever. And that way you can get clientele within the law firm and eventually clientele outside the law firm. So that's my little bit of advice from all the years I've been in the field.
Well, that was superb advice. So thank you so much, Jorge. And thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your remarkable journey and insights into patenting life. Again, the book Patenting Life is amazing. I recommend readers go out and get a copy. And Jorge, thank you so much for all your time today.
Thank you, Lisa. It was very interesting, as I knew it was going to be.
Thanks for listening to Autumn on the Air with Lisa Mueller. Get social with us and share your thoughts. You can tweet us at AUTM or visit us online at AUTM.net. We'll be back next week on the air. Be sure to join us.